How did you develop your treatment methods as you worked with survivors of mind control, and that, and you recognized that's what you were dealing with? How did that change how you approached the treatment?
Well, my clients taught me. One of the things I really realized in the beginning, from the beginning, and I know that I have a lot to learn. I know that, that's the premise I operate from. I know that from doing the trauma work that people really know what they have to do to heal. And all you have to do is really listen through what they're saying, because they're telling you all the time what they have to do to heal, so you let them take the lead. And this is no different. I mean, the clients, they know. The other thing is with the dissociative identity disorder, which used to be called multiple personality disorder, I know that there's someone in the system. I didn't know this concretely before, but I sensed it. There was a feeling that there was a part behind the scenes directing the process, and that I could trust that part to know what it is that we needed to do. But I have always known that the people know what they have to do to heal. So that's what I started relying on again. And so in the course of that, and the other thing is a form of partnership, so that if we design an intervention or if a memory comes up or something comes up, we together figure out how we're going to deal with it. And it was that way that, you know, I developed the ways of working with it. And then I also like to know, and I guess I was trained this way as a student, to form hypotheses, to check them out, to really think about what it was, because a lot of times I'll do something intuitively, and then I have to think about what it is that I did and why did it work, and what was it about that that worked. And so I began thinking a lot about that. And then the other part of it is that after I testified in Washington, I started getting calls from therapists and clients from all over the country. And they also, in terms of their struggles as to, because they would tell me what was working and what wasn't, what kind of therapist helped and what kind of therapist didn't, what kind of approach helped and what kind of approach didn't. A lot of them were calling for therapists, to find out in their region. And so I also learned from that, and I was always trying to figure out what is it about this that I was doing differently, say, from other people, why was it working, and then finally I realized it was kind of like, oh, okay, the light bulb went off, and I realized that I was dealing with programs as memories. Rather than getting lost in the complexity of the numbers and the numbers and the codes were conditions. People were taught to respond. If they heard a certain sequence of numbers, they were taught to respond. If they heard tones or whatever it is, they were taught to respond in certain ways. And it was done in a deep trance state. So you had post-hypnotic suggestions that reinforced it, but it's still a memory. But if you're staying with the codes and the numbers and all the other stuff, what happens is you're really dealing with the surface of it, and you really don't get very far. You know, I mean, you can. I had a therapist I was talking to, and I talked to her. I guess she started about the same time I did, and I talked to her probably about 6 months, a year ago, and she told me that they had gotten every single code of every altar. And I said, and, you know, well, I can call out any altar I want to and talk to them. I said, well, how is that helping this person function better or whatever? Oh, well, and she just didn't get the concept that what you want to do is get these kids out of where they are or the parts and either integrate it or into a safe place, but it isn't necessary to get the codes to do that.
Right, so what you're saying is that your approach is not necessarily deprogramming per se in terms of dealing with what was done to them in terms of programming, but to disable that programming, really kind of
at its root.
Yeah, by remembering what actually happened.
Yeah, and the thing is that adheres to good therapy principles.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I've always stuck to that. And I guess partly because once I started doing this, I couldn't find anybody else to talk to. It was really difficult. I practiced in isolation from, I guess I started in September of 92 until March of 95 when I went to Washington. I basically worked alone. I had nobody to talk to, and it was really lonely. Luckily, I have a peer group here who are very supportive of me, and people here are really used to the fact that I'm always on the edge in terms of pushing the next frontier in terms of treatment, you know, that like, for example, in the middle 70s, I was treating perpetrators. Well, that was a no-no back then. People wouldn't talk to me because I was treating perpetrators. And then in the 80s, that became kind of a common thing and accepted. I did family therapy with, you know, people, perpetrators and kids and whatever at certain parts, and that was also a no-no in the late 70s. But it became part of an accepted treatment protocol in the 80s. So I've always kind of been on the forefront. And so I got a lot of support that way. But what was difficult was there wasn't anybody that understood the language or the specifics. And, you know, that was hard. But on the other hand, it threw me back on relying more on what my clients were telling me what was useful and helpful. And they all knew that they had to do memory, that they had to get through. They all knew that instinctively. They knew that that's what they had to do.
So what happens when... does that constitute healing, that kind of part of the abuse, when by the actual act of remembering what had happened?
I do not think that, first of all, doing memories does not always mean reliving them totally. For some clients, they need to do that because their worldview is that they have to experience it and feel it, and they're like that about everything, that they don't believe anything unless they can touch it and taste it and feel it. Or if there's so much pain, they have to kind of dive through the pain to get to. But my view is we're looking for the knowledge. We're looking for what is it specifically that happened that is producing behavior in the here and now, or thoughts or feelings. And so by getting a knowledge base, we're looking for information about what happened so that they can... And once, what I find is once people get that information, what happens is they go, oh, okay, and they don't have to do it anymore.
So by just the simple act of remembering that information...
Yeah. And remembering how they learned to do this specific behavior, mm-hmm. When they see the connection and how they were conditioned, it's like, I don't have to do that. Also, what you want to do is with the, you know, because these people are either dissociative disorder not otherwise specified, which is like ego states, feelings, but not full-blown alters, that in they don't come out into the body and introduce themselves. They're not, there are parts, they're differentiated, but not to the degree as, say, someone with full-blown DID or multiple personality disorder, where the parts come out and have distinct names, distinct identities. They come all the way out into the body and function for the person who's the core birth personality. And then there are people that are kind of in between that are, and I have a peer group now in Atlanta, and it's a group of people, I guess mostly from the South, who are doing this kind of work, and we've kind of put our heads together, gotten information. We have someone who comes and gives us information, and you know, we've kind of put our heads together in terms of figuring out treatment, and that's been really useful. But basically, we've termed it sort of fuzzy DID. They're not as undifferentiated as, say, DDNOS, it's called dissociative disorder not otherwise specified, but they're not quite DID, and it's more like the parts blend with the core birth personality. And sometimes they may come out into the body, but only for very brief periods of time, but they're not as well developed. And it's kind of an in-between. And that's where most of these people are that I've seen, it seems like, and the experience of the people in Atlanta is that that's where they kind of are. And it makes it hard to diagnose because it's fuzzy. I mean, it's like they lose time. They have some of the same symptoms, but you don't real. The switches are a lot more subtle and a lot more rapid. Where with someone with full-blown DID, you know when someone new has come into the body. I mean, it's just, it's real clear that that's happening.
How does this fuzzy dissociation relate to the amnesia barriers between the identities and the uses of mind control?
Well, basically, the way that I have come to understand DID or fuzzy DID is you basically, I'm just going to explain to you what, because it's a simple explanation, but basically what you have is a part that's the core birth personality, which is the original personality born into the body. It's not a baby, as was commonly thought, and it would make sense that it's not a baby. What happens is a child, say, under, I would say this develops the way that these people have it, under the age of 5 to 7, probably under the age of 5. But you have a very small child who is confronted, and the easiest way I can explain it is because there's abuse in the family. And so what happens is this person who's hurting me, I also have to love them. Well, little kids don't, under the age of 5, can't handle ambivalence really well. So what they'll do is they'll create, just naturally, create a part, those who have the ability, they'll create a part to take the hurt and be hurt, then they'll create a part that says, I love you, whoever it is that, you know, when, so they can hold those two mutually incompatible thoughts and feelings at the same time. There has to be amnesia between them, because the part that is taking, being hurt, can't, would be too confused by the having to love this person who's hurting them, and the part who has to love would be too confused, you know, being hurt. So there has to be an amnesia barrier there. And that's the purpose. So as time goes on and there's more abuse and it's prolonged, the child naturally creates more and more personalities. And all of the personalities have a job. They have they're created for a purpose. It's either to hold memories or to hold feelings, because in abusive families or abusive situations, kids are not allowed to have feelings. If they cry, they get hurt. If they get angry, they get hurt. So they have to create parts to hold the feelings and emotions. If you're being hurt at home, then you have to create parts that will go to school and function, that will deal with the outside world. And the core birth personality, therefore, is always protected and allowed to grow up fairly normally. Now, what'll happen is you'll be presented with somebody who looks kind of flat, who doesn't have a lot of feeling, who seems kind of pale and passive. But the reason is because all of the things that make for character have been split among the parts. So that when she needs anger, she switches or blends with another, with a part. And so that's what how all of that develops. Well, for some kids, they it's just depending on what's needed. They don't develop it as fully. For kids that are really, really, really severely abused and at a very young age going into this, I think that the personalities are more well-defined. I don't know what the difference is as to why some people are full-blown DID and others are the, you know, less. And I hate to say less well-developed, because it functions very well. I think they do what they need.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they go to the degree that they need in order to survive.
So at the time this blending takes on between the core person and an alter, does the person have access to the memories and experiences of both identities at that point, or what happens at that blending point?
Okay, the blending point, when a part blends with the core birth personality, if they have a job to do, they will just do that job and know the memories don't leak. Although that part is acting on memories or acting on things that they were told that they needed to do in order to protect the core birth personality. But as far as giving memories, the parts know where the core birth personality is at all times and understand their primary function is to protect the core birth personality, so that they will only give their memories when the core birth personality is ready for them. And since they're inside. See, and the thing with the amnesia barriers, going back to your question before, with the amnesia barriers are the core birth personality is protected from all this information and knowledge by amnesia barriers. May not even know she has or he has parts. The amnesia is to that degree. And that's a protection.
Right.
By the same token, the parts inside know that the core birth personality exists.
Yeah, this whole process of dissociation seems to be more of a defense mechanism to trauma than a so-called disorder.
Absolutely. It is the most, I see it as a coping skill, mm-hmm. and it's the most creative coping skill that I've ever seen. I mean, it's unbelievable how well it functions for people. I have a client that's real sick and chronically ill, physically ill. And her doctor recently said to me, I can see why this DID is so how this can be really functional. He said, because if I had all the things wrong with her that she has, I'd be nuts. Said, and she copes so well. And he could see the value of being able to dissociate in order to deal with this myriad of symptoms that are hard to diagnose or even just really uncomfortable to deal with. So it is. It's a wonderful coping strategy.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I see it. That's how I work with it.
Right. I just wanted to go back to the point about remembering to disable the programming. You spoke in your presentation about trigger words or sounds or phrases that were used to bring out the different identities. By the process of remembering, does that disable the triggers as well?
Yeah, because basically, okay, the way that this works, and again, what you have with the mind control is a systematic way of trying to structure someone's mind so that people could have total control over them. So that's what we're dealing with here. They were dealing with very young children, as young as 2 and 3 when they started. Some were older, but most, they found that, I think, 2.5 to 3.5 was, from what I understand, the best age to start, because their minds were much more moldable at that point. And what they did is they created what they called the matrix inside their head. And it can take on a lot of variations and forms. The most common one is they talk about it like a Rubik's Cube. And they started with a simple 9x9 tic-tac-toe matrix. And each little square was a cell or a room. And every time an altar came out or was created through the pain, they would condition that altar to respond to a certain word, letter, number, whatever. And then they would have to go into their place in the matrix. And that cell had that number, whatever. So that, and they kept track of all of this, so that if they needed a part for a specific job, and they knew what they all were because they either gave the jobs, or if the kid or the child spontaneously created jobs, they knew what those were, they would just call out the number designation and get that altar or that group of altars that would suit their purpose at the time. And so that's how the numbers and stuff. Well, in the course of treatment, where I start is with safe place imagery. The core birth personality creates a safe place. There's a protocol for doing that. But most of the time they already have it. This is good trauma treatment. I mean, I do this with every single client that reports any kind of abuse. That's where I start. And these people, you know, mind control victims are no different than that. So create the safe place. And then the task is to work through the matrix. And see, once a part's job is over, they can either integrate or go to the safe place. They don't have to stay in there. Once we get the information or they understand, and then also the number refers to the cell, not to them. That's not their name. And when they realize that, because they think it's their name, but it's not, because they often have other names. So once they realize they don't have to stay in there anymore, they end up going to the safe place or they directly integrate.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times, if they go into the safe place, they'll go there, rest a while, and then integrate. So your task is to clear out. And all the kids, or the parts in the matrix, are all the parts that were harmed in the mind control experimentation. The other thing is they were told to stay in their cells. They couldn't talk to anybody. They couldn't talk to the core birth personality. They had to stay isolated. Well, these kids were as busy undoing it as it was done. So a lot of them, and I would venture to say probably most, whether they admit it or not, then created halls and tunnels, caves or rooms behind the matrix, because they learned they could create this matrix. Well, why couldn't they create something else? So a lot of times when I hear an image of a cave or a tunnel or a hall or whatever, I'll ask, is that yours? Did you create that or did they? And if the kid created it, then we know it's a defensive thing. It's useful and it's there for a purpose. If they did, then we know that it's something we have to either bypass or deal with or whatever and get rid of. But we use that series of tunnels and hallways and whatever in the back. It's like a maze, and that's kind of how I visualize it. We're working through a maze, getting all the kids out of the matrix. And once the matrix is empty, you can blow it up. It doesn't need it anymore. And then there's always more after that, because usually there's more than one, and I'm not going to say how many because I don't want to be suggestive. Mm-hmm. But there's more than one part to it. And, so you just keep clearing out until you get to the end of those, and then there's other memories that come, and then you're done.
That seems to be a prerequisite to being able to heal and have a good therapy session, is creating that physical safe place within the actual environment, and also, as you were speaking, the emotional and mental safe place within the client.
And it's great containment because, even when they say, because there was a lot of stuff done around, there's no safe place. Mm. Well, there always is. There always is. I mean, whether they admit it or not or whatever, there's always, because children know better that there is. They can create something in their mind. Mm-hmm. So that can't. You know, I'll get that. There's no such thing as a safe place. And I'll say, oh, yeah? You know, I don't believe that. You know? And sure enough, there will be something there that they have constructed behind barriers and walls, and often using their pain and their methods to hide it. You know? So they have to go through pain to get it. And then we just clear out all that stuff and let them get to it directly.
After
again, that's working with the metaphors and the images.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as the memory work is concerned, I have clients who, if I say, they come in, they've got body pain or something going on, I'll say, what's that associated with? What does that remind you of? What's going on? And they give me a picture, and they'll say, oh, they did such and such, such and such, such and such. And then they'll just describe it. They don't have to abreact it. That's not a necessary ingredient for everybody. For some it is. For some it is, as I said. But
could you just explain the term abreact?
Okay, abreact means totally reliving what happened with all the pain and the confusion, and as if it happened again. And my concern sometimes about abreactions is that you're just re-traumatizing people, you know, because they're reliving the same trauma. But when you add in the twist of you're looking for information about what happened, and they're analyzing it and looking at the information, then it is not traumatic. If you go into it as a cathartic relief, just the discharge of emotion, and then I really think people get traumatized. And I'm going to ignore that. People do get traumatized, and doesn't also work. I've had a lot of people that were seen by other therapists in the 80s who are coming back to me now, coming into therapy again, because they did all this relive abreactive work, and the symptoms and the memories are coming back because they never got the piece of the knowledge and the understanding of what it is that exactly happened to them.
Mm.
And when we do that piece, it's like it gets finished. And so that, to me, that's like the crucial piece.
So
the knowledge.
In some of your clients, you're saying that they don't have to abreact to go through the remembering process, and they're able to avoid the body memories as well?
No, they're not.
Uh-huh.
They're not. They have body memories.
Mm.
But one of the things I do with body memories, I'll ask, take a look and see what's causing that. See, I don't suggest at all ever. I'll just say, what's going on? What's causing that? Take a look. And they'll tell me. If it's electrodes, and they'll tell you in a lot of different ways, if it's electrodes, I'll just say, well, you can take those off there. And then one of the parts of the safe place is to develop a healing pool, because water dissolves everything. And so we can take, and the reason that works, or if their needle's stuck or if they have limbs dislocated, sometimes with their permission, what I'll do is pull their shoulder a little bit, and it's sort of like if it's dislocated, pull it out and put it back in the socket. Or sometimes I have to take off the electrodes initially until they learn how to do it. But the reason that works is because at some point in that memory, they had to take the electrodes off, and they had to put everything back, you know. They couldn't leave needles in them. They couldn't leave their shoulder dislocated. So at some point that did happen, and all we're doing is fast forward memory to the where everything was put back in place.
After being exposed to the information about government mind control experimentation, how did you pursue finding more out about this?
Well, it's kind of like a double-edged sword for me, because what I started doing as I got information from people, I started sending it to people doing research like Alan Shefflin. I sent it to Alan Shefflin for verification, because I had no idea what was going on. I had no idea who any of these people were, and they would call me back and say, Valerie, do you know who so-and-so is? And I'd have no clue who so-and-so is. And so it turned out to be people that were involved in this, and I had absolutely no idea, nor did my clients know. A lot of times the names would come out in really painful memories, but they really, I mean, I didn't know, and they didn't know. And so in order to do treatment, I don't need to know who was who and what they did and all that kind of stuff. I just pass that information on to Alan. I have not read in the area. My clients have not read in the area. I don't want to read, because I don't want to know more than my clients do. I don't want to take a chance of cueing them or reacting to something. Now, of course, with some of my newer clients, I do know a lot, but my interest at this point is really in figuring out this treatment process and really figuring out how to get these people functional.